Good morning. My name is Kanapilane Matjake, member of the committee. I will be chairing today's session because the chairperson of the portfolio committee is not here this morning. Honorable Mathole Motshega. I guess everybody has got the agenda with him. May I take the opportunity of welcoming you all. What we'll be looking at today is the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services. In terms of the agenda that we've got before us, we will be starting with analysis of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services 2013-14 annual report that will be presented by MPO. And then thereafter, we will then have the submissions from various stakeholders as outlined in the agenda. The format of the discussion will be such that we will have the presentations and at the end we'll then engage, have discussions and questions. Are we in agreement? Thank you. Can I take the opportunity, before that, let me just indicate the apologies. I've already apologized for Honorable Motshega. There's also an apology from Honorable Maila, Honorable Swart, and the Honorable Breitenbach is not going to be here in the afternoon. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Honorable Members, colleagues, members from Department of Correctional Services and the Judicial Inspectorate. Chairperson, the purpose of this presentation today is to assist the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services, Justice and Correctional Services on its deliberations on the annual report of JICS. And this is in line with Section 55, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, which states that the National Assembly is required to provide mechanism to ensure that the executive organ of state and public entities in the national sphere of government are accountable to it. I'm not going to speak to the mission of JICS. The structure of the annual report, as we have seen, Chapter 1 focus on statutory mandate, Chapter 2 focus on administration, Chapter 3 looks at inspection, investigations, complaints and mandatory reporting, Chapter 4 looks at community oversight and stakeholder engagement, and Chapter 5 looks at special projects and research. As we've noted, the current inspecting judge was appointed on 1 November 2011. Also, the chief executive officer, Mr. Karelse, was suspended on 12 September, while Mr. Masondo, who is the director, was since appointed acting CEO of the inspectorate. And we hope, Chairperson, that the inspectorate will inform the committee as to what are the processes at this stage in respect to the suspension of the CEO. Chairperson, we've noted some of the key successes and challenges reported by the inspectorate in the annual report. Among them, there's been a substantial decrease in the number of disciplinary matters from 12 in 2012-13 to 2 in 2013-14. I think the inspectorate should be commended for that. We can see that the employees are behaving now. Among the key challenges, almost half of the employees of the inspectorate are on contract, 46%, and I think this remains a pressing issue for the inspectorate, and it affects their service delivery. Also, the lack of commitment to fund the new post-establishment by the Department of Correctional Services remains a challenge for the inspectorate. We hope maybe in our engagement with the department tomorrow, the committee will inquire from the department as to what is the progress in terms of this funding. Chairperson, we've seen that the inspectorate has overspent their budget by 5 million. Another challenge is the allocation of office space by the Department of Public Works. I think the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services the previous year, in their oversight visit, they've noted the issues of office space in Judicial Inspectorate offices, still a challenge, Chairperson. And also there's been a decrease in the number of females employed by the inspectorate from 52% in 2012-13 to 46% in 2013-14. In terms of administration, we've observed the inspectorate had 45 approved funded posts on their fixed establishment, and one position was vacant as 31 March 2014. They also reported there were 38 staff on fixed contract, as opposed to 34 in 2012-13. As indicated earlier on, there were only two disciplinary cases involving staff, as compared to 12 the previous year. And in both of these cases, final written warnings were issued. And the staff of the inspectorate has attended a number of training workshop courses, which have included in their annual report. In terms of their budget allocation, they received 31 million, which represent 0.17% of DCS budget, and their final expenditure at the end of the financial year was 36 million, and there was overspending by 5 million. We've seen that the compensation of employees took 30 million, goods and services 6 million, communication 333,000. Also, I'm not going to speak to all this, I'll just skip. When coming to issues of IT, we've noted that the inspectorate depend on many transversal systems of DCS. The email system used by the inspectorate falls under DCS, and the internet is also controlled by DCS. And this is one of the issues that has been raised in terms of the independence of the inspectorate, that they rely too much on DCS. Which might have a negative impact, particularly on people that are supposed to serve, which are the inmates, because they view the inspectorate or the ICCVs as an extension of the Department of Correctional Services. The CETA provides inspectorate head office with IT support for all hardware and software related matters, whereas DCS provides support on all network related matters. We hope also the inspectorate might be able to indicate to the committee whether there are any challenges with regard to IT, particularly from CETA as well as DCS. What are the challenges that they are experiencing in terms of CETA and DCS? We've seen that they had 20 vehicles as opposed to 22, of which they indicated that 4 are older than 10 years, with extremely high mileage, and they indicated that the fleet of vehicles is insufficient to meet the inspectorate's operational needs, and in some instances the inspectorate had to borrow vehicles from DCS, and it goes back to the issue of independence as well. If offenders see the inspectorate employees using DCS vehicles, obviously in terms of perception, it might have a negative perception to inmates. An inmate might feel that how will these people be able to assist us in resolving our complaints and issues whilst these people are the extension of DCS. I think the issue of independence crops in now and then, Chairperson. We've also seen the inspectorate depends on funding from DCS in order to purchase their vehicles. They've also reported in terms of inspection, investigation, complaints and mandatory reporting. They've given us the figures in terms of composition of inmates in correctional facilities. I'm not going to speak to those in the annual report. They've also, in terms of inspection and investigation, the inspectorate indicated that they conducted a total of 91 inspections in correctional facilities, and there were a number of findings that they've observed, infrastructure inadequate, insufficient programs, occupational health and safety, 15 instances. In terms of insufficient programs, I think it's a challenge, Chairperson. I think it's good that the inspectorate highlights some of these things in their annual report, because now it goes back to the issue of DCS, whether the programs that they provide to inmates, are they sufficient for rehabilitation purposes? It's unfortunate that it doesn't indicate which centers specifically are those where the programs are insufficient. But I think the committee will need to probe further with DCS in terms of how do they intend to improve and what are the challenges that they are facing in terms of providing sufficient programs to inmates, because we talk about rehabilitation of offenders. The white paper says that rehabilitation should be at the center of departmental activities, Chairperson. We also observed there's been a total of 20 investigations which were conducted, and the number of centers investigated due to allegation of serious assault by emergency support team. I think this is a concern, Chairperson, to say that the EST, in most cases, they've been implicated in assault of inmates. And to what extent also are this assault can be related to the issue of torture, we shall speak to towards the end of this presentation. And the complaints unit of the inspectorate received 1,115 complaints from various sources, and most complaints relate to transfers, 243, other, 181, parole, 115, assault, inmates by officials, 109. These are the complaints received by the complaints unit, not complaints received by the ICCVs at specific center, which I'll speak to at a later stage. We've also observed that there's been an increase in the number of deaths in correctional facilities, unnatural, 46, supposed to 57 in 2012-13. We've seen that there's been issues of suicide, hanging 20, medical overdose 2, self-mutilation 1, smoke inhalation 2. Issues of segregation, Chairperson, there were 8,397 cases of segregation reported to the inspectorate. Now, Chairperson, I think the issue here, since the inspectorate relies on the department to submit reports on segregation, there should be a way in which the inspectorate can verify if the number of those segregation reports are accurate. This is because, Chairperson, we've noted now and again the Auditor General always raised the issue of the accuracy of the report by DCS. So my concern is whether the inspectorate, when they receive these reports from DCS, do they have mechanisms to verify whether these reports are accurate? I think this is one of the concerns that I've noted. Again, in terms of mechanical restraints, there were 271 reports on the use of mechanical restraints received by the inspectorate. Again, also here, Chairperson, I'm also raising the same question or concern to say that the inspectorate, do they have a way to verify whether this number of mechanical constraints reports, can they verify whether they are accurate? You might find that maybe they've been receiving less than what is normally happening in correctional facilities across the country. The use of force, there were 191 reported cases. We've seen that there's been an increase in the use of force cases reported to the inspectorate. And my concern here, what are the difference between the use of force reported to JIFS and assaults reported to JIFS in terms of officials to inmates? And it goes back to the whole question that I've raised around the issue of torture from officials to inmates. And I'm also still emphasizing here that there should be a way in which the inspectorate can verify if the number of reported cases on the use of force is accurate. In terms of community oversight and stakeholder engagement, ICCVs, they've indicated, are appointed for each correctional facility after public consultations and nominations, and ICCVs are independent contractors who are remunerated on the number of hours they spend at correctional facilities. I think the issue here, Chairperson, we noted that the ICCVs, they are independent contractors, and they are getting paid in terms of the number of hours worked. I think the committee needs to check with the inspectorate if there's anything stopping this ICCVs from performing other duties outside. outside their normal working hours, because they might be allocated specific number of hours in a particular correctional center. Beyond those number of hours, are they allowed to do other work somewhere else? And that might also affect their work as ICCV in correctional facilities. If, for instance, that particular ICCV is employed at Shoprite Checkers, and he got a shift to work on Monday, of which he's supposed to work at the correctional center. So how do they deal with those dynamics? So I think the committee can also probe the inspectorate to get a response around that. I think also it's important for the committee to understand how are the complaints recorded, particularly by ICCVs in correctional facilities. I think it is one thing, if one offender, because they've indicated a number of complaints received by ICCVs in correctional facilities, and this complaint relates to transfers, communications with the families, and so on and so forth. So I'll be interested to find out how do the ICCVs record this complaint, whether one offender can report on assault, can also report on lack of contact with families, can also record on assault, how do they categorize those complaints received by the ICCVs. And we've also observed that the inspectorate currently has 309 ICCV post establishment, but there are only 273 ICCVs, and they reported that some of the ICCVs served two correctional centers. And we are aware that most of our correctional centers are overcrowded, got a number of inmates there, and I'm trying to make sense in terms of how would one ICCV, you know, work in both correctional facilities with thousands of inmates in those facilities. I think it also goes back to the issue of assisting the inspectorate with funding to be able to absorb staff in order to promote service delivery. These are some of the challenges that are experienced by the inspectorate. They are not able to employ staff on a permanent basis because of the issue of staff establishment. We also observe that in terms of assault and torture recorded by the ICCVs, there's been an increase on the number of complaints relating to officials to inmates assault from 3,317 in 2012-13 to 4,203. Those are the assaults, alleged assault by officials to inmates. And as indicated, it goes back to the whole question of how do those assaults can be related to the issue of torture. This is in line with our recent law legislation on torture. How do the ICCVs are able to distinguish whether this alleged assault, are they only a just assault, or can they be said to be torture? I think we need to the committee needs to probe further there, and whether if the ICCVs are they trained to whether distinguish whether there's been any torture committed in respect to all this assault, particularly assaults committed by officials to inmates. And I think we need to also look at how can ICCV assist us in identifying those cases of torture, Chairperson. And also, there were 450,000 cases, requests and complaints dealt with by ICCV in 2013-14 financial year. I think the concern here, what are the outcomes of this complaint? Because it should not just end there to say that we've received so many complaints. What are the outcomes of those complaints? How do those complaints are being dealt with? by the ICCVs. I think maybe the committee might need to get an understanding as to if an offender comes to an ICCV and report or do a report in terms of assault or a request, how do they, the ICCVs, deal with that particular request? Do they just send this request or complain to the head of center and wait for the head of center to respond to the ICCV, and the ICCV take that respond back to the offender concerned? In terms of, because the ICCV are supposed to resolve complaints, so how do they, in that particular process, how do the ICCV facilitate the issue of resolving the complaints? Are they just messengers? So I think these are some of the issues that we need to understand from the inspectorate in terms of the specific role of the ICCVs with regard to facilitating those complaints. And we've seen that majority of the complaints, requests and complaints related to the lack of communication with families, 68,000, transfers, 60,000, healthcare, 52, and bail. I think also communications with families and transfers, they might be an interlink there. Because if an offender has been incarcerated in a center far away from the families, obviously there'll be a challenge in terms of the communications with their families. Maybe they might not have enough contact in terms of telephone, but definitely in terms of visit, that's going to be a challenge. Hence, I'm saying the issue of communication with families and transfers can be interlinked. In terms of recommendations, I'm going towards the end, Chairperson. So there has been an increase in the number of requests and complaints dealt with by ICCVs. The inspectorate should find a way to report on the outcomes of these complaints and requests. And the issue of funding for the inspectorate should be looked at, in particular funding for the new approved structure, because this structure, I've been told, it has been approved by the previous minister as to why the structure has not been funded up until now. I think it's the issue that the committee needs to probe from the DCS. I think the portfolio committee needs to also engage with their counterpart, the PC on Public Works, to inquire into the delays by DPW in finalizing the procurement of office space for the inspectorate. In terms of specific recommendations, Chairperson, convert the because we've in the annual report, they deal with chapters, but I'm thinking, can't the inspectorate, in terms of their chapters, convert them into programs? For instance, administration as a chapter can be a program one as administration. Program two can be inspectorate, investigation, complaint, and mandatory reporting. Program three can be community oversight and stakeholder engagement. Program four can be research and special project. I think also this will also assist in terms of, because somebody might say, but now the inspectorate does not get their funding from Treasury. They only get it from this. But I'm saying, because there's still those debates in terms of the independence, how are we going to transform the inspectorate to be an independent structure? This will also assist, you know, in that particular transition, while still busy resolving the whole question of funding of the inspectorate, whether it should be from the, it should continue coming from DCS, or whether it should be from Treasury. So in the meantime, the inspectorate can look at transferring those things into programs, and also allocate budget for each of the above programs, and report on expenditure for each program, because looking at their financial section, the inspectorate does not indicate in terms of whether the budget allocation for those specific chapters. So if these programs, maybe they can also allocate funding in terms of this amount has been allocated to administration, this amount has been allocated to inspections and investigation, and so on and so forth. But also the inspectorate can also look at the possibilities of setting indicators and targets in terms of their programs for each of those targets. This is in light I was looking at the annual report of the Civilian Secretariat of the Police, because also they've done the oversight over the police. So they've also transferred their chapters into programs, and are able to set targets. And this thing they've started while they were still busy negotiating to getting their funding directly from Treasury as a transitional tool. So they started this process long ago. So they didn't wait for Treasury to allocate a specific budget for them. So I think this is in light of that the inspectorate could look at the possibility of doing that. But I also, because we don't have a way to measure whether the inspectorate succeed or not, because they don't have targets, no indicators, so we can't see whether what is it that they've achieved with the amount that they've been provided from DCS. I think that brings me to the end of my presentation, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the briefing. That was Mr. Mpoma Tabatis, the Parliamentary Researcher for Correctional Services and Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services. Any clarity-seeking questions, members? I'll recognize Honorable Mpumlana.
Hello. Yes, is it on? Hello? Okay. No, I... Now, after I have heard who you are, I probably not sure whether I should give this question to you. Because you seem to be raising problems, and no answers, really. And I was wondering if the organization has discussed the matter with DCS, all these problems that you have raised. And secondly, I wanted to know the same questions that you asked. We want to know how do you operate? How do you relate to the DCS? What are the issues that you discuss with them, and what do you recommend? That's basically. So now that you are a researcher, I don't know whether I'm a bit confused. What do you want us to do?
Thank you, Honorable Mpumlana. I think maybe for now, what you would say is that the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services will be presenting after lunch. So if you want more than what has been presented now, you are definitely going to get answers from them. Is that in order? Okay. Can we go back to the agenda? We have VET Justice Project, Sonke Gender Justice Network, National Institute for Crime Prevention and Reintegration of Offenders, Gender Health and Justice Research Unit, University of Cape Town. Basically what we will do, we're going to allow all of these organizations to present, and we'll give each organization 10 minutes to present. We're not going to discuss the reports as they are presented, except for the VET Justice Project one, because there's a special request that they be allowed to engage because they have to leave. We will actually make a special concession for you, but otherwise for the rest, we will have the presentations and thereafter engage. Is that okay? Great. Over to you, VET Justice Project.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for inviting us, and thank you very much for having us. My name is Robin Leslie. I'm the researcher for the BITS Justice Project. Our presentation will be short, and we look forward to discussion on some of the points that we raise at this time. I think, firstly, the BITS Justice Project would like to congratulate JICS. They've produced a really excellent annual report. We're really pleased to see that there's some detailed feedback on investigations, as well as a focus on use of force and the emergency support teams, which is a very important issue. What I'm going to do is raise 4 points that we'll then discuss in more depth. The first of those points is something else that we're very pleased on, which is the annual report is taking a very considered view of the role of the Independent Correctional Centre visitors. It seems to be really considering how to make this a profession within the correctional environment, which is something we support. Secondly, there's a strong sentiment throughout the report, which is also one we support, that a separation of JICS from DCS, financially and otherwise, remains one of the biggest stumbling blocks to effective oversight. Along with that, the frequent highlighting throughout the report of the limitations of the JICS mandate is also a very important concern for the BITS Justice Project. In addition to these issues, we'd also like to highlight and raise the issue of creating a positive and functional feedback loop regarding reporting, which is something we'll go into in depth a little bit later on. So beginning with the issue of separation of JICS from DCS, this isn't a new issue, this isn't something that's the first time you're hearing this, but JICS really does remain too tied to the Department of Correctional Services, both in terms of budgetary decisions and budgetary allocations. So just two small examples, the Independent Correctional Service Centre visitors, often rely on correctional centres for infrastructure and supplies, and some of the correctional visitors that we've spoken to have explained how uncomfortable they feel when they are writing a report, a negative report, on a DCS staff member or even head of prison while using that staff member's office, computer and telephone. So that's very problematic. Also something that the annual report raised was the fact that the training and accreditation for the Independent Correctional Centre visitors remains uncredited by CETA, and this is supposedly due to budget constraints, and that's a really crucial issue if we're looking to professionalise this. Moving on to JICS's mandate, it's a significant obstacle to empowered oversight. The fact that JICS is unable to make enforceable recommendations, is unable to hold DCS to account regarding JICS findings and investigations, and has no referral power to the National Prosecuting Authority. And this is very frustrating not only for JICS, but for civil society, because JICS is one of the only institutes in the country that has access to prisons and access to investigating issues and allegations. And yet it has no power to compel accountability or change. So this is something that really does need to change. When considering the position specifically of the ICCV program, we note that JICS has raised a couple of issues in their annual report, and we'd just like to raise a few points ourselves. It's no secret that the ICCVs are very overburdened. Our statistics say 850 inmates per ICCV. We see on the presentation it's probably closer to 530. Once again, that's still an amount that's untenable, particularly because ICCVs have to interview 25% of the prison population each month, in addition to taking complaints. We've already mentioned the issue that ICCVs must resort to borrowing DCS computers to file reports, as well as to communicate with JICS. And I'd just like to go into a little more detail regarding the problem of ICCV's contractual obligations or contractual situation. They sign a short-term contract that is only renewable a few times. So you're training a set of employees and then limiting the amount of time they can actually be useful. In addition to a short-term contract, that gives the ICCVs a not very secure job prospect, which means many of them see the Department of Correctional Services as a long-term job prospect given their training and their experience. This ultimately creates problems in terms of developing relationships with inmates, but also in terms of how the ICCVs feel empowered to report. It's unlikely that you will be very keen to be honest and open and critical about an organization you're eventually hoping to work for. So that's a real problem that needs to be looked at. And it's heartening to see that JICS is taking this into account and considering the ICCV structure. Another thing that has also been raised already, but we'd like to reiterate, is the training of ICCVs. So it's a very it's actually a very difficult job to be trained on how to take complaints regarding food and allegations of torture. This is a huge spectrum of issues that you need to be very, very well trained on. And by not providing the appropriate training, especially with regards to identifying abuse and torture, you're essentially providing a huge gap for these kind of grave abuses to go unnoticed and uninvestigated. So this is particularly important because South Africa did criminalize torture in 2013. And we should perhaps also reiterate that this is not a gap that's related to ICCDs only, particularly with the medico-legal profession also. This idea of how to identify grave human rights violations and abuse that is now officially illegal in South Africa is a real issue. But particularly with this these employees who really are the only people that have this grassroots access to inmates. So it's heartening to see that JICS is considering these issues, focusing on upskilling and paying more attention to the investigative needs and how to empower these ICCDs. As a final point on the ICCD issue, we'd just like to highlight that not only are ICCDs and JICS dependent on DCS budgetary and structurally, but also operationally. Going into prison is not something that you can just, you know, take lightly. The ICCDs are dependent on DCS staff both for access and for safety. So that also brings in another element of how can we guarantee impartiality and a lack of bias when you're really relying on DCS staff members to keep you safe while you're investigating. So my last point will be to discuss JICS's investigations. So knowing and understanding their budgetary mandates and human resource constraints, it is actually great to see the publishing of little snippets of investigations in the annual report, and we're really heartened by that. Our concerns, though, do remain, and particularly regarding this idea that I mentioned in my small introduction, that JICS needs to create a positive and well-functioning investigative feedback loop, both between JICS and DCS, but also between JICS and the public. So without consistent, thorough investigative reports being made available to the public, we have no way of ascertaining whether JICS's oversight mandate is really being fulfilled. So this issue has been highlighted particularly for the Vets Justice Project by our recent attempts to ascertain the state of investigation into allegations of grave abuse, torture, and forced injections in the privately run Mangaung prison. So I'm just going to quote one inmate, Willem Fiss, and what he told our journalists. "It feels like my jaw is falling off. I feel dizzy, my muscles are spastic, and my memory has gone." That's what happened to him after he was forcibly injected with an antipsychotic drug at Mangaung Correctional Facility. The seriousness of what is alleged to have happened is also illustrated by this quote. "They told me to strip, they pinned me down onto a metal bed frame, poured water over me, and shocked me with their shields." This is what happened to inmate Simpiwe Deniso. He told the Vets Justice Project how he was then taken into single cells by the ninjas, otherwise known as the emergency support team, where he claimed, "They kicked me in the face and broke my cheekbone." At this point, it's pertinent to note, as was recorded in the presentation earlier, that the use of force records have increased from 83 last year to 191 this year. The South African and international outcry stemming from the allegations of torture and forced injections at Mangaung prison do not seem to have been met with a similarly urgent and transparent response from DCS or JICS. We have repeatedly requested DCS to make their investigations public or at least provide us with reassurance that investigations are ongoing. Equally, we have requested information on the progress of JICS's investigations. The few lines that we can read in the annual report simply do not do justice to the scale and seriousness of what's alleged to have happened there. And without this kind of transparency, we just cannot be sure that oversight is functioning. And we are particularly concerned to read in JICS's annual report that DCS has provided Mangaung prison with a report of kinds, and yet JICS has not been included in that. So why is JICS, and therefore the public, being cut out of the feedback loop? That's something we would love to know. So in conclusion, we are clearly in sympathy with JICS concerning its legislative limitations, and having met and engaged with ICCDs, we see this as a platform, as a fundamental resource and opportunity actually to practice effective oversight, and empowering and therefore retaining these individuals is crucial to credible reports and complaints mechanisms. And with South Africa criminalizing torture in 2013, proper investigation into allegations of abuse has become even more important. If the public is to be reassured that such violence does not go unpunished, JICS's investigations become one of the most important lines of defense. And equally, the oversight role that this committee plays in ensuring these feedback loops mentioned are better developed is of paramount importance. And we note that this committee has sent recommendations regarding JICS to DCS, published in the DCS annual report. And we look forward to hearing what your next steps will be. Thank you very much.
Honourable Self.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the presentation, which I think sheds some very important lights and insights onto the Judicial Inspectorate. May we perhaps know very directly, Madam Chair, may we know very directly at this point from DCS whether in fact they have supplied a report of their investigations to Mango Ung and to no one else? I just understood that the WITS project were about to leave, so I thought they should...
Can we hear from JICS as to whether the report has been submitted and how has it been submitted since?
Good morning, Chairperson, Honourable Members, and fraternal friends from the NGO sector. The simple answer is no. We have requested the Mango Ung report on a few occasions, and we haven't received the Department of Correctional Services' investigation report into the Mango Ung affair. And perhaps I can just preface that you will see it in our annual report, where JICS itself had investigated. In fact, we took statements from Mr. Fiss and St. Piwe, where they made allegations. There was a defense from G4S with regard to the legality or otherwise of using those injections. So we have one part of an investigation, but not the response from Mango Ung or DCS in respect of the Mango Ung.
DCS?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The investigation at Mango Ung is concluded save for the response that we are supposed to get from the operating contractor against whom the allegations were made. Once we have received their report and have brought that into context with the findings of the investigation, the department shall then be in a position to provide that to the inspectorate, judicial inspectorate, I'm sorry. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Justice Project, are you fine with it?
That's great to know, and we'll be looking forward to reading that report as and when it's published. Is it possible to get a time frame on that? Is G4S being responsive? It has been a year since these allegations were made.
Can you get a comment from Honourable Smith before DCS response?
No, Chair, I think Vitz has said exactly what I wanted to say, that there can't be a situation where we're investigating for more than 12 months. Because if there must be corrective action taken, the sooner we do it, the better. Now, the real question that must be answered is what is the holdup? If it has been done, what is the holdup in terms of why can't that report be tabled? So I want to say exactly what the previous speaker said, but if the department can't give it to us today, we're interacting with them tomorrow. We request that they go and find out exactly where it is in the process so that we can debate it thoroughly with them tomorrow. But to give us an undertaking that this committee will indeed take your concerns, because we agree with the matter that justice delayed is justice denied. So we will take it up tomorrow, sir.
DCS, are you agreeing that you take it tomorrow or you want to respond immediately to that?
Honourable Chair, I think it would be advisable and sensible to provide that response tomorrow to the Portfolio Committee. Thanks.
Any further questions and comments on this? Honourable Mutapu. Go on, let's hear something else.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by appreciating the presentation by Justice, Vice Justice Project. On page 13, Chairperson, they made mention of insufficient training by ICCVS. Maybe, may they be specific or maybe give a sort of a recommendation on specifically on what will they love to see this ICCV be trained on. And again, there was a lot of emphasis from researcher and Vice Justice Project on independence of GIFs. Will they kindly elaborate on that, on the independence level? Thank you, Chief.
Maybe before you respond, let me just make a few comments to that. Indeed, I think the problem of reporting, like it has been outlined by Mr. Matarate, is problematic. It's something that we will engage GIFs on in the afternoon so that we can see to what extent we can really manage to deal with this. Also, that what has been highlighted is separation of GIFs from DECs, which we'll still look at. And another thing that is connected to what Honorable Mutapu has just put forward has to do with the mandate and independent and enforcement mechanisms. And my take in this is that, yes, indeed, maybe there is a concern about enforcement mechanisms, but at the same time, we need to look at the extent to which we can utilize systems and mechanisms and services that are already available, so that you don't find that at every event when work has got to be done, then the same structure that has been established is expected to become everything and all. Because I'm just thinking, if it's about human rights violations, why don't you just connect with the South African Human Rights Commission? Because we have so much of institutions that are there to support democracy, that we should actually devise systems and ways of utilizing them to ensure that the rights of our Africans, including the South Africans in prisons, are properly protected. And indeed, with training also, I think it will be important for you to actually just give some ideas as to what you'd actually like to see happening when it comes to what you regard as, I don't know whether it's sensitive interventions, that they are trained, but whatever they actually have to come across would be much more than what they have actually been trained for. And you have also raised the question of short-term contracts. And you are actually recommending that there should be long-term contracts. And you look at the population that you're talking about, that has got a huge financial implication. So I think sometimes when we engage on these things, we need to actually manage to create some form of a balance by actually also bringing some of these components in so that we can see to what extent whatever we are actually putting forward is something that is feasible. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Chip.
Sorry?
Thanks very much. Thanks for all those comments. I'll just go through them one by one. I think in terms of the ICCV training, I think the first step would definitely be to develop that CETA accreditation, because that's immediately setting in place a series of norms and standards that can also be evaluated. both in terms of course content and in terms of how well you do when you're undergoing those courses and trainings. And that just professionalizes the entire system and gives a set of standards, which is a really a great first step. In terms of the specifics that we feel are currently lacking in terms of training, once again, this is not unique to the ICCB profession. The fact that identifying torture, identifying assault, identifying grievous bodily harm, all these things, it's a nuanced approach that first of all requires medical, some kind of medical training, but also requires other kinds of knowledge, such as if there's been an allegation of assault, you need to be there within 48 hours because the body heals, bruises heal, boot marks. One of our investigations into abuse in St. Albans Prison, luckily we were, or the lawyers were able to get in there quickly enough to actually see the bruises were boot marks. If we'd been in a week later, it would have just been an indiscriminate bruise. So that kind of knowledge, knowing that you need to be in there within a certain amount of time, you need to be looking for. We had a torture expert speak to us recently about the kind of marks that electroshock could leave. And it could look like any number of minor injuries, or it could be as a result of an electroshocking. So this kind of knowledge, I think, would be really helpful for ICCBs to know. Secondly, an element of psychosocial training, both in terms of how you as an individual cope with investigating grave human rights abuses and complaints, and secondly, how to appropriately identify someone who is mentally unwell in terms of a suicide risk. These are all things that are you know, usually covered by social workers, but really what the ICCB becomes to inmates is a lay medical consultant, a lay social worker, a lay, you know, they become everything because they're probably the only access point in terms of complaints that these inmates have. So it's really important to give that kind of nuanced training. But yeah, I would definitely say CETAs and accreditation that way would be a great first step. Then in terms of specific recommendations regarding independence, the first would be quite clearly that the budget is assigned directly from Parliament for Treasury, so that there's no muddy waters between what's assigned through the Department of Correctional Services. And I think that would also help in terms of budget allocation. Of course, an increased budget, that would always be great. And I think also empowered by infrastructure. I think Mpho did raise this issue that the Department of Public Works really should be focusing on providing infrastructure that supports Jits' independence. How to empower ICCB's infrastructure is a bit more of a tricky issue, what kind of equipment you give them, and whether there's often not even a space for inmates to receive visitors, let alone for ICCBs to interview people, which is why offices are often used and shared. That's something that I think requires a little bit of further thought. In terms of the ICCB, one last issue raised was the idea of contracts. I don't think we're suggesting that ICCB should be permanent or long-term staff members. What we're saying is that they should have a career track, a career plan, and some kind of job prospect. I'm not 100% sure what that would look like, but what is clear is that if it's simply a 6 months, 12 months, 18 months you're out, this is not going to be a situation that's going to inspire ICCBs to not consider correctional services as a long-term job prospect. So perhaps some kind of career planning, 6 months, 12 months in ICCB, what's your interest? Is it in social work? Then maybe you can be streamed into a social work role at a different institution or a different level. That's the kind of thing, just considering the career prospects and planning rather than just slapping a five-year contract on the problem. The issue of enforcement, when we're saying that JICs need more powers, we agree that the best thing to do would be to use reporting mechanisms that are already in place. But what we're saying here it's not proactive, it's reactive. We're saying this because we've seen the failure of these reporting mechanisms. We're not saying off the bat that JICs should have more power. We're just saying due to the situation that these issues are not taken forward, can we not therefore empower JICs? Reporting to the Human Rights Commission, indeed, is something we can do. It's something we have done. But it seems that because JICs occupies this relatively unique niche in our oversight framework, it seems a pity that all we're letting it do is report. And I think I'll end there. Thanks very much.
Honorable Smith.
Thanks, Chair. I suppose it's not only to VITS, but it's to everybody else that's a stakeholder here. You know, the issues raised in the report of the judicial inspector are not new. And every year you come to us and you give us exactly the same story that we've heard before. The only new initiative was our debate last year around the independence, and I think that's something that's going on. But what I'd want you to do for us, we've got 241 centres. If you came to us and said to us the ideal organogram and responsibility of such an institution is ABCD, it helps Parliament, because we are then able to engage constructively with the Minister and the Department. My frustration, Chair, and I'm not blaming it on anybody, is that we really just come and regurgitate what is there every year. People are assaulted, suicides go up, but we've not collectively been able to say this is what needs to be done. To learn from IPED, to do as the Chair is saying, how do we coexist, if at all, with the Human Rights Commission and other bodies, so that we can have that intelligent discussion, and as Parliament then we can initiate something, which I do think we need to strengthen it. But for 14 years or 20 years we've been having the same discussion, and we're not moving forward. So, Chair, I do think that between now and the time that the budget is brought to us next year, it would be helpful if South African society could say to us, this is what should be in place. One, to proactively stop torture, because we've now ratified that piece of international legislation, and we are then able to engage with the powers that be in the department, because I can predict that we'll have this discussion by the time I leave here in 2019. Unless we do something. And let's debate it. I mean, we had, sorry to do this here, but Mr. Self will bear with me. We had that discussion about CCTV cameras and so on. There's movement happening there because we dared to what do you guys call it, break the envelope or whatever the case is. That's the challenge I'm putting to you. What do we do with this? Should this be there in the first instance? And if it should be there, what should it look like? For me, that's the real discussion that we should be having. Then all the stuff about money, about whether it should be independent, those become secondary to the objective that we want. I don't think we should be talking about how much money they should be having, because money is not going to solve the problem. Do we need it? In what form do we need it? And then debate the money. Because we really put these guys in an inevitable or in a loose situation. If we just say to them, do A and do B and do C. So for me, I thought that should be the interaction that we should be having with stakeholders, and then challenge the department and also the inspecting judges. I know the inspecting judges' views, but I don't want to talk on his behalf. But I really think that's where we should be going to now, if we are serious about the role of chiefs. Thank you, Chair.
Justice Project. Honourable Smith says you can also assist to come up with solutions.
Thank you very much.
So that you can actually assist us to move forward. One thing that has actually come across very clearly is that the reports don't actually manage to help you understand as to what exactly is happening in prisons. Maybe we need some kind of a format that would actually manage to assist us to really clearly understand. And once we have that, then we can be in the position of actually also to manage to measure impact. We now have all these many ICCVs. Is it really necessary to have them? What are they doing? Is what they're doing really making impact or a difference in the life of the prisoners? We need a system like that. So moving forward, what Honorable Smith is saying is that we need answers and solutions more than just complaints. Thank you. I can see your hand. That's right. I'm going to be recognizing yourself and this Justice Project again and then close so that we can be in the position to move forward.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, on behalf of the judge and my principals. Of course, we'll have an opportunity to engage more substantively this afternoon with the law objects. However, I must, for the record, say that if you look at the progress, and I don't want to defend chicks, from the year 2000, as to how we became more and more inquisitorial, you actually, if somebody read that report, I would be very strongly suggesting that you'll get a sense of what's happening in prison. That coupled with visits, parliamentary oversight visits, will give you a sense as to whether this is a success or not. So, with great respect, regurgitating the same old, JICS would ask itself, and we'll raise this afternoon, Honorable Smith, is that the role we play as a reporting body without the powers we have legislatively, that this parliament can only increase, is the one aspect. But as I understand parliamentary oversight, is that we'll give you a report. We will critique the department or praise the department. It's the role of parliament, in our view, to ensure that what we put out there is actually carried out by the department. And that feedback loop, in our view, is probably missing as well. We've raised many, many interesting things. So it's not just complaining or increase of powers, but it's this committee's view. In the last session, the last parliament, we've raised many things about deaths, about investigations, ESD, we have raised, and we would think that the enforceability will come either from legislative change, goodwill from the department, and I'm not painting the whole department as bad, and most importantly, the challenge for us would be parliament. The members of parliament who sit and say, you're an organ of state, come and report to us, we report, and then look at whether there's a different view from the department and whether on the merits we're right or wrong. So I think there's a positive side to it, but to ask the same question in the last parliament, which was asked also, do we need to exist? What's the role of ICCBs? How effective we are? In the legacy report that was written by the last parliament, those are the same questions raised. And of course, the reciprocal question we would ask is, how effective is parliament in enforcing some of the matters that we raise vis-a-vis the Department of Correction Services? So I'm throwing it out now as a debate. We accept criticism. But on the other hand, we go back and we say, what do they really mean by saying, do they really need us? How do they measure us? Accepting, of course, we're not a perfect organization. ICCs do need training. And oversight visits and parliamentary oversight is so important, as I understand the Constitution, to say, what does Parliament do to keep JICS under the cosh? And if JICS raises it, what do they do to say to the Department, be specific with regard to, what have you done in this particular matter JICS has raised? You'll see in our annual report, we talk about suicides. We will say Section 65B of the Correctional Services Act has been breached. And now the next question is that we can't change it. We don't have the power to enforce. We put it out there as a reporting body. And the change must come by this Parliament measuring whether the Department has changed. And of course, reciprocally, if Parliament says to us, change, whatever, include torture as a category, we've actually have done that. So I'm saying, you know, there's a two-way relationship, and for us it will be seeing Parliament actually taking a greater inquisitorial role, measuring whether what we have said has merit or demerit, or it's a piece of nonsense written on a piece of paper by so-called investigators, which we will argue, and then say to
Thank
the
you
department.
Very much. Not trying to cut you short, you still have the afternoon with us. What I would actually like you to do in the afternoon, because what you're actually putting forward now is that there are certain matters that have been reported to Parliament that you feel, in your opinion, Parliament has not really taken action on. Would you be in the position to bring those up in the afternoon? Because we promise you, as this committee, that we intend really addressing anything that comes to us in the form of a recommendation, as long as it belongs here.
Please, Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Nushin Irfani. I'm the project coordinator of the Vic Justice Project. I just wanted to thank the Honourable Mrs. Smith for raising the issues of the need for really open, solution-oriented discussions around the role of JICs. And in fact, I'm going to speak now on behalf of the Detention Justice Forum, which I sit as coordinating committee. It is a forum of about 20 different organizations that work in the field of detention. We have made a submission that's in the pack. But one of the things that we have been focusing on for the last year is this idea of JICs and what it should look like. We've had roundtables, we've had a research report, and we in fact have for quite a while now been requesting a workshop with this committee to do exactly that, to debate what JICs should look like, what should be its powers. To look at whether we actually need it or not, to look at the ratification of the OPCAT, which looks at the national preventative mechanism and which then would have an effect on what oversight roles should be. I think we were slated for a day or two, and then I think that there were some shifts in the committee's program, and so it didn't happen. So I'm delighted to hear that you would like that engagement again, and we offer reiterate our offer to host that workshop, to bring the report that we've done, to report, bring the outcome documents of roundtables, and to have that discussion with you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Just to emphasize that stakeholder participation is always important. I'm sure we can release you now. Is Sonke Gender Justice Network ready? Over to you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Marlies Rester, and I'll be presenting a few thoughts from our submission. And thank you for allowing us the opportunity to do so. I would like to introduce Sonke to the Portfolio Committee and touch briefly on the work that we do. Sonke uses a human rights framework to achieve gender equality, prevent gender-based violence, and reduce the spread and impact of HIV. And we work specifically with the Department of Correctional Services to address these issues, and includes areas of policy advocacy and capacity building. We have various curricula, One Man Can and Brothers for Life, which we implement in peer education programs in DCS facilities. So we work within DCS facilities and then also on a policy level. The submission focuses on two main issues, and the discussions that we've just had, I'm going to suggest that I move through JICs independence quite briefly. I believe we'll discuss this in much greater detail later in this session and this afternoon, but particularly to draw honourable members' attention to sexual abuse, which will form the second part of the submission. I believe a lot has been said about JICs independence, and in our submission itself you will find a research report on recommendations that Sonke has made, and together with engagement on the Detention Justice Forum we've hoped to move forward, as Nushin has noted. But to briefly talk about some research that we've been involved in last year and this year that might cast some light on the daily workings of the ICCVs. Our research was conducted in all of the management regions of JICs. We had two monitoring forums, forms that were developed, and we rolled these out in seven of the visitor committees and four management areas where we interviewed ICCBs and participated in their meetings. And some of the key findings from our interviews with ICCDs, which I think might be useful to this committee, is some of the issues that's been mentioned plenty of times this morning and that JICS raises within its annual report as well. It's the issue of office space, where ICCDs note that they have to interview inmates in hallways, and raising issues of confidentiality, especially in terms of sexual assault, and how the lack of privacy might inhibit the discussion of sexual assault within DCS facilities. Once again, the issues of own computers and phones, and then worryingly that heads of correctional centres often do not attend visitors' committee meetings, which is ideally the spaces where some of these complaints would be thrashed out. Often, DCS officials who do attend the meetings do not have the decision-making power that heads of correctional centres would have. So that from this research project specifically, a number of the recommendations about improving the working of ICCDs was calling for greater support from the JICS head office, regional managers and the visitor committee's coordinators, the practical dependence on DCS, which is a refrain, the cooperation between JICS and DCS head offices, calling for increased participation by decision makers in the VC meetings, and increased civil society and stakeholder engagement with the ICCDs. And then once again, the issue of ICCD training. Some of the recommendations that we've made before, which is included in the submission, is in this publication, with some of the issues that we've highlighted already this morning. Coming to the second part of our submission, is to draw honourable members' attention to the fact that sexual abuse is widespread within DCS facilities. This is something that is borne out by research, as you can see from the statistics that we quote there, and it's clear in the DCS policy on sexual assault, which is what I would like to focus on. By a report by JICS in 2007, inmates report that sexual abuse happens often, sometimes, or very often, which is a great cause of concern. We commend JICS for disaggregating sexual violence complaints from the general assault category. But we note that in its annual report, there's only 10 cases of sexual assault that have been reported. And we believe that this is not a true reflection of the extent of sexual abuse in correctional facilities. What we recommend coming from the annual report and from the work that we do in correctional facilities, we believe that the training of objects and DCS staff on the Sexual Offences Act and the sexual assault policy is vital. And tomorrow in our submission on the DCS annual report, I will speak in more detail about the policy that's also appended to our current submission. We believe that it's very important to disaggregate sexual assault data in terms of rape, sexual assault, compelled sexual assault, and sexual harassment. JICS, to its credit, has a specialized sexual assault complaint form, which we would like to see you be used more broadly. And then, of course, our strongest recommendation is about the implementation and the monitoring of the sexual assault policy within DCS. In conclusion, we strongly recommend the independence and autonomy of JICS and the implementation of the sexual assault policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions and comments, honourable members?
Thank you very much. I'd just like very specifically to ask about the sexual the policy framework to address sexual abuses of inmates, because I mean, as you say, I mean it's not 10 sexual abuses that have happened in the reporting year, it's 10 sexual abuses that have happened on average per hour every single day of the week, I should imagine, if you had a realistic figure. So the first question is, why do you think there's such a huge degree of underreporting? Is it because people are scared? They don't feel safe enough to report it?
Is it because people feel ashamed and disempowered? What is the underlying cause of underreporting? And secondly, that I'm concerned that the screening tool has yet to be developed, because at this time last year we were told that the screening tool was being developed and would be implemented. So are we to understand that when somebody is admitted to a correctional facility, there's still no assessment tool to determine whether that person is vulnerable to sexual abuse? Is that what is being said? In which case, I would want the DCS to note that down as a question they might want to respond to in due course.
Honourable Chavalan.
Thank you, Chair. It's almost a related question. I think my dilemma sitting here, having not gone on oversight to actually see what's going on there, is why are the inmates themselves having to be the ones that report? Where are the orders? I mean, we understand the culture of the violence inside the prison. That is, an inmate I might choose to suffer through and not report. But isn't that exactly the job of the orders? Because no one is violated in silence. Surely there are cries and screams. So where are the orders at that particular time? That's my dilemma sitting here. I think to stretch the question further would be, are they part of it? Perhaps is that what I should conclude as a person not there, that they are part of this? Because surely rape or whatever, or sexual violence, doesn't happen in silence.
Thank you very much. This is...
Thank you, Chair. I think because there is going to be engagement, we should be advised as to whether we should be responding to questions that stakeholders are putting, whether we should do that now, whether we should do that later in engagement. And why I'm asking that is quite a lot of comments are being made as to the situation inside a facility by stakeholders, where I think the team that I'm with would also be able to comment on, firstly. Then secondly, was to request as well that the research methodologies that stakeholders are saying they have conducted such research, these were their findings, whether that methodologies have been looked at, because I think one of the serious challenges is that when stakeholders have information, they got it from somebody else. Whether that has been tested as well as to whether that is the truth or not, because I think for the committee and everybody here to be able to provide good advice and as well as to indicate this is the direction that needs to be taken, you then have to be having facts so that we are able to do that. I'm just requesting that we be guided by the Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have agreed earlier that seeing that the stakeholders are here, when matters are raised, you should rather respond, even if we do know that we will be engaging you later, so that you know this is an easy way of clarifying whatever is brought up today. In terms of your latter concern about validity of the statistics that are actually being brought to us, I think it actually goes back to stakeholder participation, which means there isn't really engagement, which I would like to actually encourage. Once there's engagement, by the time you all come here, you will have engaged outside us. So it will then become easy. So look at ways and means of actually engaging, so that if there are statistics that are there that need to be interrogated, you could interrogate even the source of the statistics before you actually even come to us in the future. But the first comment was that maybe respond to some of the information that has been given to us today. Department of Correctional Service, Honorable Chabalala, was asking a very serious question to say, where is the, what are the wardens? Why should it actually be an inmate that reports? And we just feel because you're here, maybe you can actually just indicate what is the system. And if it's something that's too lengthy, you can indicate that you will show you the information in graphs and whatever in the presentation that you're going to be making to us.
Chairperson, thank you. I think we shall be able to provide information as to the reported cases by officials, by offenders, so that we can then form an opinion as to who should be able to report. What I can just explain practice, and I think that's also what the judicial inspectorate officials are doing. Every morning is standard practice to go into cells and engage offenders. Every evening, the same gets done. It depends on the offender to come up. But what our officials are doing, especially those that we see are vulnerable offenders, we are then in a position to identify and separate from other offenders. But rape cases have been reported by officials, and proper action as to reporting that to the South African police and providing also treatment is what gets done. And I think the department shall be in a position to provide a clear report in that regard. I think we'll go and prepare that. But what I was trying to get the chair to indicate to us whether we should respond was that VET Justice Project, chairperson, especially with regard to the Mangaung report, one of the journalists by the name of Ms. Ruth Hopkins was the journalist that wrote the entire issue in the Mail and Guardian. And we have a report that talks to the Mail and Guardian findings as well as what transpired thereafter. I was checking with Ms. Jolingana, who was acting before I came in, to establish as to whether we have received a request from the Judicial Inspectorate Office as to provide us with a report. The only request that we know is the one from the Human Rights with regard to the Mangaung report. I do not think that there could have been any problem in us providing to the Judicial Inspectorate the report that we have, be it a report that needs to be responded to by the operating contractor. But I think maybe between ourselves and the Office of the Inspecting Judge, we should be given the opportunity to discuss this further after this meeting. Lastly, maybe to also indicate that at each and every correctional facility, and I want to talk to the independents, the operators of the Judicial Inspectorate that work at each and every correctional facility, because of our understanding that the Judicial Inspectorate was established through a legislative process, it is therefore going to be important that we are being provided with guidance, because the department has committed itself to take this matter up, establish a task team from the Judicial Inspectorate, from DCS, but also learning from IPIT, what were the processes that were undertaken so that IPIT could be the independent organization that it is now. So that by the time we come to the portfolio committee, we then have a presentation that talks to the pros and the cons and what should be the way forward, whether we need any assistance. I think that is the commitment that the department is having. And once this has been clarified with the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, I think the department shall then be in a position to come to the portfolio committee to do that presentation. Thanks. Sure.
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much. Can we now continue with our agenda? We will now receive a report from National Institute for Crime Prevention and Reintegration of Offenders.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson and the committee. Nicole, just want to thank the committee for this opportunity once again to present a submission on the JICS annual report and focusing on the period not just 2013-2014, but basically the trends from 2009. My presentation is quite a long one. It's for your own reading. I won't go through it all. But it basically has an introduction with some general comments, a reflection, just talk a little bit about the administrative report, reflections on complaints, special report on children, just touches on the issue of medical parole, and then on the strengthening of JICS and the strengthening of the ICCVs, maybe even looking at that structure that Honourable Smith mentioned, and then some concluding remarks. So I've only got 10 minutes, so I'll try my best to get through it as best as possible. I just want to start with saying that the state must be willing to restrain itself by creating and sustaining independent public institutions to oversee its actions, demand explanation, and when circumstances warrant, impose penalties on the government for improper and illegal activity. Now, it's apparently a litmus test for our democracy, the issue of openness, transparency, and accountability. And as the Vice Justice Project said, I hope it was the Vice Justice Project or Sonke, without transparency and accountability, we can't say we have effective oversight. If you look at the different definition of impunity, it is exemption from punishment or freedom from the injurious consequences of an action. And I think just at the start, this is what's important. If things are raised, there has to be accountability. It's great that we're increasing our transparency and openness about issues, but some issues are still not transparent and open. And it's important that things, that consequences happen for when there's an issue that's not being taken up. And I think we see that consistently in the reports over the years, I'm just hoping we can move forward with that or find some other way to get this right. It is the role of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services and the Inspecting Judge to be overseers for the protection of the constitutional rights of inmates in the correctional setting. As their logo suggests, they hold a magnifying glass to the treatment of inmates and the conditions of their detention as an important method of guarding against unjustifiable limitations of rights. NICRA would also like to congratulate the JICS on their report and all of their efforts over the years to improve the state of corrections in South Africa. We have worked close enough with them to know that they do put in a lot of effort. We've had, in terms of our complaints that we take to the JICS of the DCS, we've always had, timeliest reports, and they've worked well on the issues that we've raised with them. But in saying this, I hope our JICS colleagues will also appreciate our constructive guidance in terms of solutions and a way forward regarding the report. As I said, there's definitely an improvement to the past reports. We are seeing more analysis of some issues. There are some schedules on investigations and inspections and outline on recommendations. And obviously the reports that over the years have done well to expose the violation of rights of inmates in these centers as well as other issues affecting correctional management. It would be great, though, to have a last section on analysis, discussion, and summary of all recommendations. We recommend that recommendations must be categorized into systemic and thematic priorities with specific timeframes, and that a schedule of recommendations be kept to monitor over the medium to long term how these are being dealt with. We would also like to urge that the committee to do something similar in terms of the recommendations made to the DCS and make sure that we monitor this as well. The report is a treasure trove of information, but sometimes it is a bit difficult to read through the detail to pick up some key information. So I did kind of start an example of a table at the end where you can put all key information in one table. It just helps us to look at it. So Annex to 1 gives an example, but I'm sure you can do better at that. To put it together as a summary on Annex, then we can see the information in terms of assaults, deaths or whatever over the years, so we're able to get a better picture of it. With regard to the thematic reports, I mean, they could be, you're asking what exactly is going on and what is the overview of corrections, what are some of the key issues, like the issue of children, the issue of sexual assault. We need more thematic reports from the Judicial Inspectorate on this. I mean, it's wonderful, over the last 2 years, there's been one on health, and now they've done something on children. But we do need more on some of the issues, gang violence, whatever the issues are, the use of force and the ESP, we need more thematic reports so that we can engage those issues much more. The issue of the emergency support team that has come up in the report is concerning, and I think linked to the issue of the legislation on torture, it has to be looked at as a matter of urgency. I just want to look at this quote that was said by someone working in the correctional center. Only a month or so ago, we couldn't work where we normally do because the task team, the EST team, went into a section and we are not to be there to hear what happened. The task team visit at an undisclosed time various cells that they claim are security risks. They beat the guys with batons and search for illegal things. But we have no proof. We are not able to take phones into prison or take photographs, so it is our word against theirs. So there is some seriousness with regard to the EST that has to be looked at, and there's criminal issues if it comes to inhumane treatment and torture. So we do support the DIC's recommendation that this matter be looked at urgently and the comprehensive review of the role, functions, authority and methodology of the EST be reviewed. In terms of general comments, in 2013 reports, the overcrowding and conditions in centres were recorded to be unacceptable. It is the DIC's issue that this could be a management problem at the centre level, and maybe that they're not employing best practices, and that innovative practices from management are needed to resolve the overcrowding problem or any of the other issues. So you can see in the report there from centre to centre, based on the leadership in that centre, some centres worked better than others. So I think management is something that one needs to look at with regard to centre management. DICS also talks about the reduction of the inmate population. I think it's important that those specific strategies be continued to be monitored. The report shows shocking figures, and it's not highlighted as shocking enough in the report about the combined figure for juveniles and children on remand is 18,227, representing 41% of the prison population. I mean, that's an alarming figure. It's very concerning that we have this many children and young people in our prisons, and we should be asking the question, why do we have so many children in prison? I know the DIC looked at monitoring the conditions of children in these centres and juveniles, and that should continue. But more importantly, why are we having children still in our facilities? No child should be caged. We had a huge campaign. There was a Child Justice Act that was passed, and we're still finding an increasing number of children into our system. And I think the inspecting judge is right to say that that's his concern. But I think we need to work more rigorously to get children out of correctional centres. But we're doing a research now together with some other organisations that are looking at children in alternative care, which is a huge problem. Because, I mean, you're looking at 41% of the population being children and youth. What is happening to the future in terms of South Africa if our children are going to be starting off in prison? And so this is a concern, and we want to do research to show that even child and youth care centres, some of these children, we should be asking the Child Justice Act, and there's a committee that said that you should monitor why are children in prison, why are they being detained, why aren't they being put in child and youth care centres. And even child and youth care centres have become many prisons, and this is not good for children and their development. Actually, we're doing more harm than good, and we're supposed to be working in the best interest of the children. So I really hope that we can take up that as a strong issue and really work rigorously to ensure that we do something about it. The graphs in the annual report is great to show over the years. It shows increases and decreases. That helps a lot to see an overview of the situation. It also highlights challenges with regard to access to medical treatment, gang activity and gang violence, although not enough. we still don't see enough in terms of strategies of dealing with gangs, and that's another thematic area. I know the DCS is busy working on gang management strategies and all of that, but we don't hear enough as to what's the strategy, what's working, what's not, and I think we need to be open about those issues so that we can try and input and bring more solutions to the table. Not all inmates are benefiting from correctional programming, from the report, and literacy, education, and skills program. There's issues of hygiene, education, and we have seen in the report a slight improvement in community correction and correctional supervision functions, which was great to see. More attention has to be given to the analysis of information. There's lots of pieces of information, like Paul talked about transfers and communication with families. Those are huge issues. I mean, there's so many tens of thousands of reports from inmates on complaints about communication with families and transfers. And I think it's important that we should be listening to the complaints of inmates. And we need more analysis of these issues. Why is it happening? Because, I mean, families is key in rehabilitation and reintegration. So we need to examine that much more and then look at solutions. There's also, what we'd like to recommend also, there's lots of tables I've looked over the years and some very useful tables and graphs that have been in previous reports. And it would be nice to keep including that consistently over the years. Like before they talked about overcrowding in different centers, and that was useful to examine which centers are overcrowded and then how have they been doing with regard to that. So we'd like to see that again so that we can measure over the years how are these centers increasing and improving and that sort of thing. But it was good to see that there was a lot of inserts around inspections. And with regard to complaints from ICCVs, we'd like to recommend that maybe these be written from the highest to the lowest complaints. So it gives us what's the biggest problem that inmates are complaining about, because it wasn't done in that order of priority. In earlier reports, the DICS used to refer to the self-sufficiency of the department and prison labor and all of that. I see it's not featuring anymore. And that's an important issue, because we're talking about how can we make the judicial, the Department of Correctional Services self-sufficient. And that's an important issue the previous committee focused a lot on. So we have to bring those issues back, including prison labor, the gardens, the farms. I know there's been progress, but not enough. Some are still not working, and I think that issue needs to come up. Similarly, as we look at the cost-effectiveness of how to run correctional services in South Africa, so we must look at cost-effectiveness to run an oversight structure like the judicial inspectorate. So a previous report talked about the budgets of the JICs and the programs and how do we evaluate that. I think that's needed if we're going to see how do we create a system that's more cost-effective and efficiently run for both the DCS and the JICs. We want the value for money and something that works. So we need to look at over how the, you know, the committee needs to pay attention to how that can increase. With regard to recommendations, we recommend this, a schedule of recommendations in electronic format if possible so that one can measure over time. I guess that's linked to the whole feedback report loop mechanism that they talked about. There was the issue of mental disorders that had come up. And I think we agree with the JICs that this needs to be taken to the Department of Health to look at urgently, because mentally ill inmates are vulnerable to victimization. They can also be a danger to themselves, to inmates and staff. And actually many of them are state patients and some of them should not be in our correctional centers. So it's very important that we look at that. With regard to administration, I think Paul mentioned most of the issues. I'm just going to say that maybe the independence discussion needs to be had first before we look at the structure of JICs. I think you have to look at them together. If you can look at a structure that's more independent, what do we have to do legislatively, and then what is the structure that would go with that kind of independent organization. So in that workshop that was recommended, we have to look at independence and structure and all of that together. I know we're going to have the discussion about DCS, why they haven't approved the post-establishment, but it's no use talking about post-establishment. I know it needs to work now, but how do we kind of balance that so we don't make some decisions before concluding on the independence and structural issues? With reflections on the complaints, I think Paul has brought up some of the issues over the long term. The assault of inmates by officials have seemed to increase over a three-year period, with 71 complaints in 2011 to 109 in 2013. The report on sexual violence in correctional centers, we'd like to agree, is still very low. Another issue that I want to bring up is another issue we raised in the previous committee was the issue of lockup. And I think that's how we had the discussions of those cameras. Because in the period from the time the inmate, I don't know whether they get locked up at 2 or 3 till the next morning, this is when you don't have any idea what happens. To my understanding, there's no supervision at that stage, but maybe the DCS has improved that. But that was the reason why we wanted those CCTV cameras. Because, I mean, that's when the inmates are most vulnerable, and we don't know what. You said we are the warders. I think the monitoring and the supervision at that time, I don't know how it operates now. And maybe the DCS can give us a better idea if that has improved and that issue of the master key and the lockup, if it has been resolved. Because I think that's an issue that needs to come back on the agenda. The use of force, I must say, with the DCS officials increased at an alarming rate from 3 reports in 2009-10 to 191 in 2013 and 14. Now that's, it's either the reporting has improved on the use of force or we're getting into trouble. And this use of force has not only been used in DCS. I mean, we've had this whole discussion with the police. So now we need to look at it in the EST and all of that and the issue with regard to torture. But I think the training is also very important. I was driving the other day and I saw some traffic officials debating with some taxi drivers. And I was thinking, do they have the skills in terms of resolving that conflict with the communication? And I think that's what it also comes back to. Sometimes we can get so frustrated and impatient. I mean, we must remember that the EST is dealing with aggressive inmates, sure. But that's why your skills level in terms of how you engage with someone who's highly aggressive, how do you mediate that? How do you? And I'm not sure how well trained and skilled, and maybe the DCF can fill us in on that. And the use of mechanical restraints and segregation also seems to be increasing. Suicides is a serious concern, and we can see that there's procedures that are not being followed and regulations. I mentioned the issue of communication and transfers. It is key to look at the issue of families. The white paper on corrections talks about the importance of families in rehabilitation. And but I see the JICS is quite silent on that issue. I mean, we talk about communication with families, but we don't talk enough about their key value in rehabilitation and reintegration. How can they be further involved? So that's another thematic issue that probably can be addressed. Medical parole cases, there were some cases received by the complaints unit, but not one was recorded by the ICCVs. So I'm not sure, is that an issue the ICCVs don't deal with, or is it just that they didn't pick up the inmates and are not complaining about it? But I do raise the issue of medical parole. It is a problem administratively. I mean, we've dealt with some cases where the inmates really cannot take care of themselves. They are being assisted by inmates in the cell. And there's one guy who has Parkinson's, and it's degenerated. He put in his application, went to a doctor in 2011 already, and still is waiting for medical parole. And the doctor then said he doesn't qualify, even though he diagnosed a degenerative disorder. And he's now degenerated, and still, the application has gone to the minister's office, so they're trying to deal with it. But I'm just saying this is what's happening, and I'm not sure that the medical parole issue, it has been raised in this report, so we support that if we give attention. The special project on children, we could see that the report showed us across those centers that the children are not all receiving the rights that are afforded them. There is some issues with orientation programs, especially with children remand detention. Some are not being assessed on admission. There are some where the minimum space norm is not being applied. There are centers with cockroaches and lice infestations, hot water supply, access to outside exercise. Some of it is half an hour when there's a minimum requirement of 1 hour per day. Overcrowding some juveniles, their beds were removed and no sheets were available. And there was one case where they said the juvenile was housed in a cell where natural light was inadequate. And evolution facilities, there was a juvenile house where there's a ratio of one toilet for 44 inmates. And substantial juveniles or children do not receive visitors for some time. And I think that's an important issue, especially the issue when it comes to families, especially for children. That should be carefully monitored. So there are some where the procedure is not being followed, and I think we need to get that right. There is some non-compliance issues. Okay, so there's many, I'm not going to go to the international instruments. We know that children is an important issue. But the Child Justice Act, I did say before, says we must, the community must monitor the, monitor the numbers of children in correctional centres, the reasons for their detention, the reasons for underutilisation of child and youth care centres, the extent of inter-sectoral collaboration, access to education. Some children are still not getting education, it's compulsory. Issues of hygiene and health is apparently not progressive realization rights. They are supposed to be, it has to be available. And we're still picking up those issues coming out of some of the centers. So I think we do need attention to that. I mentioned the medical parole, just that the applications are being delayed or denied due to lengthy administrative processes, and we just need to make sure that that runs smoothly and more offenders have access to this. Strengthening of checks, I think it's been mentioned by my colleagues, and I think my point is there that we have that workshop, we look at independence and what kind of structure that kind of independent organization would have. But independence requires both financial and administrative independence, which is not the case with JICS. This has impact on the effectiveness with which it carries out its legislative mandate, with the extent to which it is able to monitor and protect the rights of prisoners. So it's dependent, JICS is dependent on its budget allocations received through the department. And according to Doug once in a report, the CSPRI report, if funding is sourced from the same organ that is the object of oversight, the independence of the oversight body and perception thereof may be compromised. It is for Parliament and not the executive arm of government to provide for funding. This could be achieved by rethinking the linkages between JICS. I think that's been mentioned before. With regard to the structure, if JICS had to go the route of independence, it was the JICS themselves in the previous annual report that mentioned that they would have to look at the internal audit function. They would need to implement formalized equity plans, workplace skills, risk management plan, fraud prevention plans. They would need to compile a JICS management information system. There need to be formalization and implementation of policies and procedures for donation, sponsorships, gifts, disciplinary, establishment of institutional budget and planning committees, as well as the specifications committee, evaluations committee, and adjudication committees. So it's just saying that we need to engage with the structure because that's the implications. Of besides the legislative changes that need to make, we need the structural changes. And in regard, we support that the powers around that JICS should have the same investigative powers as the IPED when it pertains to deaths in custody and allegations of torture, and that the JCS is not permitted to conduct investigation into such matters until the JICS has completed its investigation. That's what giving it more powers would imply. And that possible legislative changes we need to amend the mandate of JICS to empower the inspecting judge to notify directly the SAP and the NPA where he or she is of the opinion that a criminal charge should be laid against the member of the department. And the department should not be the final arbiter on whether it refers cases against its own members to the investigative authorities. That the results of investigations and prosecutions be published annually by JICS, including the reasons why the DPP has declined to prosecute with such a decision.
Yeah, left is 2 minutes.
Okay. I mean, just in terms of, Ms. Honourable Smith mentioned the structure, previously Nicola presented on this. In Ireland, we have an external oversight mechanism which includes an inspectorate, a layperson visitor committee, and a prison ombudsman, which appears to work very well. The inspectorate conducts the inspections against standards of inspection criteria. And I'm not sure we have that. We have mentioned it before. While the prison ombudsman deals directly with oversight over the internal complaints mechanism from inmates, families, or inmates, visitors, and other organizations. So the lay visiting committee is the public participation element. They separated it. So that's also something we need to look at when we look at the structure, because currently it's all just one structure. And in the ICCV, just one comment on that I would like to make, is I support all the previous speakers, but with regard to that structure of ICCVs, we have mentioned before, Paul mentioned that we need to involve civil society and stakeholders much more. I think it was that, sorry. But maybe the component of the type of people we're using to do the ICCV work, that we could use a combination of also including experts on different issues, like if it's a health issue, for example. I know Lily's unit, the gender and health unit, if that unit could, they could secure someone to go and do a particular visit around a health issue, for example. So when we go into prisons, we're actually dealing with maybe who have more expertise on health issues, or they have more expertise on correctional management issues. So maybe we can have specialized expert committees that could be latched onto the whole ICTV system when it comes to, so that we could have more engagement around some of the issues and how we could improve it in our correctional centers. So we'd like to look at that whole structure of the ICTVs, and we also support training. There's a lot more you can be trained on in terms of doing that effective work. So in conclusion, I think we support the recommendations made by the DICS of the ESP that a bill be drafted and debated regarding the suitability of the use of closed-circuit television monitoring, which I just mentioned, related to lock-up and sexual assault and all of that. And the poor management strategies at center level must be taken up. The independence of checks, the ratification of OPCAP is something that's important to ensure effective oversight in all detention centers. Okay. I think I've covered everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I can see the presentation is quite long, but we have written presentation. So we can still continue to engage on it. Thanks once more for the presentation. You see, one thing that I really think that we are missing out here is to feel how the services are actually complementing each other. You're sitting there, you're NICRO, you're reporting, and I'm asking myself, what do you do in prisons as NICRO that can make it better? Because you hear of all of these things that are happening, but you don't bring in that component of saying, for ourselves, in the meantime, this is what we did. Because when you look at our systems, we've got so much of services. But to some extent, there's no connection. And now you talk about ICCVs having to also be experts, and then you realize that the prisons themselves have got their own experts. So there's no connection, but I'm going to open up for comments and questions for the members. Honorable South, Honorable Chabalala.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. It's always, Vanessa's enthusiasm is always infectious. I really want to debate some issues. And the first one concerns children. You know, I guess everybody gets dewy-eyed about children in prison, but actually children don't start in prison, they start in crime. And the fact is that if you had gone with me a couple of years ago to see Chris Malchus and his organization at Polsmore, you would have seen a 16-year-old boy who's already fully-fledged member of the 27s. That is not a child. That is a hardened criminal through and through, committed his first murder when he was 13. You know, so I guess that the answer to children in prison doesn't necessarily lie in children in care, because in many cases the parents don't even want to deal with the children, their own children. They don't want them. So I think, you know, it's quite important not to be too simplistic about children in prison and children in care, because there are some juveniles who are psychopaths, sociopaths. They belong there. And the second...
Just a minute, Honourable South. I can see somebody taking pictures. Can we just respect the committee room? Okay.
The second issue concerns the prison... family visits and transfers, and you linked it with overcrowding. Now, if there's one thing that I get millions of, is requests for transfers of prisons, and Mr. Bondisa and Mr. Smallberger are very good about trying to accommodate them. But, I mean, everybody wants to be in Johannesburg Media, because that's where their families are. Everybody wants to be in Polesmore, because that's where their families are. But if you do that, you're going to overcrowd Polesmore and Johannesburg, and St. Albans and all the other places that are close to the big urban areas, and you're not going to deal with an overcrowding problem. So, you know, I'd just like to know, you know, I know it's important to keep families in touch with one another, and NICRO does a wonderful job about providing buses so that people can keep in touch with, you know, family, with inmates that are in far-flung prisons, but You know, you can't have the one without the other. If you give in to every transfer request, you're going to have horribly overcrowded facilities. And then this is a persistent theme that gets mentioned about why JICs can't refer matters to prosecution. Well, I mean, I can refer a matter to prosecution. Somebody, I see that something's gone wrong, go down to the police station, lay a charge. I don't know what more JICs needs than to see that there has been a crime or prima facie case that's been of a crime, go and report it. Now, it might be that there's a more efficient way of doing it by getting direct access to the National Prosecuting Authority or something like that, but it oughtn't to stop people from laying a charge if they think a charge ought to be laid. And finally, just in terms of the powers of enforcing recommendations, I mean, I think you're getting into a debate that we're having in Parliament at the moment, and it's a debate on the Ad Hoc Committee on Kungla, for example, on what is the force and effect of remedial action by the public protector. Now, you're saying here that we ought to give the judicial inspectorate, as it were, powers to enforce its recommendations to be carried out. Well, I think we need to have that discussion within a more holistic debate around the powers of Chapter 9 institutions to have remedial action enforceable. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to Nico. It's a lengthy presentation, and they are enthusiastic about what they are doing, which is commendable. Just three issues, one has been touched already. I visited Victor Fester, I think it was in 1996, from UCT doing honors in criminology, and it was a juvenile section, and the stories that came out of those 14, 15, 16-year-olds scared me. So I'm not sure if your issue with children in prison is that the prison is not geared to house children, because if you are suggesting children centers, I don't know if a person has committed a cold blood murder, one, two, three sometimes, you are going to put in a house of safety. So I don't know which one is your issue with it, but I think I would want to think that just like adults, the murders committed by children are supposed to be categorized, and clearly there are instances where children have to be in prison, but maybe the mixing with adults or other things is what should come into play. But blatantly saying that children do not belong in prison, I'm not so sure. My second one is relates to JICs. If they are a judicial inspectorate, I think I'm also concerned about their independence. Maybe when they talk to us in the afternoon, they will tell us what has been the stumbling block in terms of them achieving that semi-autonomy. And my other one is the comment you made in the document you provided us on page 12, I think it's paragraph 74, on ICCVs. You talk about their profile and that it should be beefed up and experts should be included. I think I would have thought that's what should be happening already, because if you are going to be part of an ICCV team and you do not know what's happening in correctional service, or you have no inclination of the justice system, then you are not assisting. Then perhaps maybe that's why we are saying they rely on the DCF staff to carry forth whatever complaints that were recorded. I don't know, maybe you can, that one you can answer. I think the other two DCS members, but the judicial inspector members who are here will talk to us in the afternoon. But maybe that one you should answer in terms of what's the profile at the moment in your knowledge. I would have thought that South Africa has enough social workers. I mean, they are even employed in HR. That's how much in abundance that we are. We have a lot of criminologists who are in academia because there's really no use for them. South Africa has never migrated to the utilization of criminologists like it has happened in other countries. I think we have enough psychologists too, so I would wonder who constitutes this team if it's not those people.
Honorable Smith.
Thanks, Chair. Just emphasize what Mr. Shaw said earlier on around you're not going to be able to deal with overcrowding and your passion, Ms. Padiatsi, of family involvement. You're just not going to deal with this, for starters, for the very reasons that Mrs. South has raised. But secondly, I'm not convinced that this family thing works. I come from Westbury. Every second young man in Westbury has been to Sun City. I'm not exaggerating. Goes to Sun City, goes to Leocorp, and he goes back to the family. So your contention that family helps rehabilitation certainly doesn't work in the communities where I come from. And I have argued, I'd rather not see my family because they're sending me far away, but I'm confident that I'll come out of there a plumber or a welder. I really think that skills supersedes the interaction with family if you're looking at a productive somebody coming out. Because I don't know if you've done case studies. I'd like you to come back and say to us, where have you done case studies where the family did a better job than somebody coming out with concrete skills? Because it doesn't work in Johannesburg. So that is the point that I'm making. Overcrowding is not going to be dealt with in the way that we are arguing for it now. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Honorable Smith. To reiterate the whole issue of partnership, it just feels like you have your own story, there will be another story, and Jake will have his own story. And if it's Nicola speaking, when it comes to the issue of children, we are supposed to actually be championing this, the social workers, to tell us where are the probation officers, have you ever seen the probation officers' reports and things like that. So that it actually helps us in terms of really understanding what is really going on. But I think it's about not engaging. We all work in our own corners, and we come and we present reports with the assumption that whatever you think is happening, that is happening, because you have not engaged. I don't know whether you're ready to respond to some of the comments, but we want to continue to thank you for the good work that you're doing. What we're just actually mentioning is just to actually assist processes moving forward so that it then reaches our processes. We don't actually enter into discussions and engagements that don't actually help us to move forward.
Thank you for that, Chair, and I want to start by answering your question. I do agree that that's why we're all here, because we all have a part to play, and that we don't just bring up issues at this committee, but that we start engaging with each other earlier. And that's what we do. We have a relationship with the Department of Correctional Services and the Judicial Inspectorate of Correctional Services. So these are not new issues we're just bringing up here. This is issues that we are engaging with them about as well. I'm sorry that it didn't come across in my presentation, but you're right, we've got to put it all the pieces together. And we're one of the greatest advocates on coordinated responses and working together in a much more holistic way. So I do support, and maybe we can give more examples of that the next time we do report. But I do agree, we can't be working in disaggregated from each other and in silos. I think that causes some of the problems we have. With regard to, can I go ahead and answer the other question? With regard to, Honourable South's input on the issue of children, we are very passionate about it because we know those case histories of children who have committed heinous murders and even killed their families. But as a society, we are responsible for children that got that way. And families, I know Honourable Smith, are the nucleus of your society. If we're going to carry on excluding the family from rehabilitation, reintegration, involvement in their children and juveniles' lives, I mean, it's children and juveniles that are not getting there. You are actually taking away the responsibility of the families that need to be empowered, need to be strengthened to take responsibility for the very children they brought up into this world. We can't absolve them, and then the departments take away the responsibility. Families are key. We have a white paper on families. Every department is committed to make families central. I agree on the issue of overcrowding, but I'm not saying that that should be the strategy where we take away the fact that there's overcrowding. Families at the center. The white paper says this is at the center just as much as rehabilitation is. So if you're dealing with the issue of overcrowding, okay, we know we have to move that. There's no other choice. We've got to move that amount of offenders to another center. Then how do we ensure that that offender has access to his family? I mean, NICRO for many years have been providing a bus service. This is something that needs, we know families who become even more impoverished when the inmates go into prison. Because they must find money to access to go and visit. We see the struggles of especially mothers who can't go to see their people. They don't have the money. They have to raise it. They have to raise funds in their community amongst their neighbors to get there. And we all do nothing about it. So how do we, with DCS, I mean, that's something that we should look at as a budget for supporting families to come and visit their inmates, especially if we're committed to rehabilitation and reintegration. You asked me to focus my attention on rehabilitation. If we're going to exclude that, we're not going to get to rehabilitation and reintegration. As much as we can have all the skills, I agree the importance of skills. It's work, and meaningful work is key, but we can't exclude the issue of families. So we've got to look at strategies. If we're saying it's important, then let's look at how we can do it and balance the whole issue of overcrowding and centers and all of that. But we can't exclude it. With regard to the issues of prosecution, maybe the Jakes can better answer you. I agree. I'm not sure if they can just report on it or what is the challenge there. I can't answer on that perspective, but I agree with you that that should be done. With regard to independence, ICCV expertise, I know they are contractors now, but the Jakes could tell us better that lay visitors are actually all types of people. So we don't know, I don't know actually, the annual report doesn't specify what kind of a lay visitor type people we have. And true, it may be an assumption that they could be expertise of a various nature. And we're not saying that the DCS doesn't have the expertise, but we're doing oversight. So the DCS may have their expert, they could be part of that team, but this is an independent function. So you need your own expertise as well to collaborate with the DCS expertise. You know what I mean? There needs to be some kind of independence with regard to that. Well, maybe that's debatable. We can look at issues around that. And we will certainly like to bring more case studies. I think then you'd get a better idea of with regard to families and the critical role, especially restorative justice is playing, and how the involvement of families has been key to that as well in terms of reconciling and strengthening relationships with families. We have the whole issue of halfway houses, where offenders can't go back into their communities because they can't be reintegrated into their families and communities. And what's going to happen is if they can't go back into those families and communities, they're going to come back to prison. And we're going to carry on having the overcrowding issue, and we will perpetuate the problem for years to come. Because that is key to an individual, is to have the support of their families and their communities. Otherwise, they remain on the margins of society, never to be included in a constructive society. So these are big. We have to look at the bigger picture when it comes to these issues and where do we want to go in the long term and the value. Why do we put rehabilitation and reintegration at the center if we're not going to kind of win it or water it down?
Please summarize the answer.
Yeah, and then evidence-based practice. I'll talk about it in my presentation on the DCS tomorrow. Brings all this, the world over. These things we're talking about have been proven. And I don't know, we could do an extra lengthy presentation on children. I'd like to do that again. But we want to work with the Jakes and the DCS on the whole issue of children and broader on children in alternative care right now that are actually going from one foster home to another foster home. And that's how we're getting our juveniles and children who don't have, who are neglected. You want to know why your children commit murders, neglect, abuse? That needs to be prevented. So
thank you. You haven't touched on the probation officers and your experience in terms of those children. You asked the question, why children in prison? So I asked you.
Okay. The probation officer, in our experience, Honorable Chair, is that probation has become a checklist of issues when it comes to assessment, when it comes to, I'm a social worker myself, and I must say it really brings a profession because there's so many compliance issues. We've seen assessment reports where it's checklist, and we cannot believe that the assessment hasn't taken into account many things, because we're doing a lot of criminal capacity now for children in the courts, and the value of the assessment by the probation officers, they're not doing what they're supposed to. There's a lot of compliance with legislation that needs to be done, and it's become a checklist, and I think we're forgetting the individuals. We're forgetting the individuals in the system. So there is a problem with quality of assessment and the nature of the work, or I don't know if it's overburdened in terms of how much they have to deal with, but it's still a problem and it's still a challenge.
That the children are in prison because of overburdened.
Yes, overburdened welfare system, definitely. This cannot.
Thank you. We will then go to the next presentation by Gender Health and Justice Research Unit of University of Cape Town. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to be quick and so everybody can get to their lunch on time. I'm Lillian Arts. I'm the Director of the Gender Health and Justice Research Unit. I'm also a founding partner of the Article 5 Initiative towards the prevention of torture and ill treatment in places of detention. I've been listening to the debate today and the recommendations by members, and we take them to heart, particularly those regarding concrete solutions to some very complex problems. And the only way we can do this, in my opinion, is through evidence-based learning, understanding what's happening systemically in the system, and trying to find workable small-scale solutions so that we can start chipping away at a bigger structural problem. Unlike the other presentations today, I'm not going to be focusing, well, I am. I'm going to be focusing on what's in the JICS annual report, but I'm also going to be discussing a little bit about what's not in there, as well as what's not in the DCS annual report. And that's relating to women in prison, gender, and gender desegregation. And my comments today apply to all sorts of vulnerable groups. We just happened to have done research on women in prison, but I could see while we were in there that a lot of what was happening in terms of the treatment of women applies to other vulnerable groups. So open your mind to the idea that we should be taking these issues on board. Just in terms of the background to the submission, this is an evidence-based submission. It's based on research we've been conducting. We recently finished a study which was done kind of in partnership with DCS. I mean, they were very supportive of our research. They were extremely happy with the findings, and that was on women in prison. And basically, it wasn't about conditions of imprisonment, but how women got there in the first place. And we asked them a very simple question: how did you end up here? And some of their stories started off when they were 4 years old, and some of them started off when they were 23, and they met this guy at a bar. And so the stories were long and winding, and we asked them basic thematic short questions about who they were, what the key life events in their lives were that precipitated criminal involvement, what the turning points were in their lives, the circumstances that led to their involvement. Also the buffers. Who was the most supportive person in your family? Had your grandma still been here, do you think you would have gotten involved? So it was a real criminological exercise in trying to understand women's engagement with the crime and violence. And we learned some very interesting things. We also did this because there was no single study in South Africa that really went into the depths of women's lives, apart from some case study that was done with women on Robben Island. And since then, we've had very little information about who they are. And in my opinion, it's important. Women are do play sort of an antecedent and other roles in other criminal activity in terms of men's criminal activity, facilitating, enabling, covering. And we wanted to get our theoretical heads around women's engagement. Before we get critics around research and academic research, we'd go through very rigorous ethics review processes that look at our instrumentation, validate our methods. We spent a lot of time with these women, about 2 years. We developed brilliant relationships with them. And even after they got out of prison, they contacted us. They're still telling us their life stories about reintegration. And have said things to us that surprised me. As a criminologist, I would have hoped that I would hear stories about not waiting to get out of prison, but a lot of the women spoke about being afraid, and that actually coming to prison was not such a bad thing. The violence stopped, the hunger stopped, the abuse stopped, they had a sense of order. I'm not saying that incarceration is beneficial to people, but I'm saying that in some instances, that structured environment was found to be beneficial in some respects. So I'm going to speak directly to the report. One of the things that I'm very concerned about is that there's certain sets of data that is not collected or is not made available. We talk a lot about in these annual reports about data not being collected. It may be collected. It might just not be analyzed or collated or brought to the attention of the committee. So we need to figure out where those data deficits are. It may not be because a lack of effort on part of DCS or JICS. Just in terms of our own work, I'm just going to give you examples of why proper data collection is important. Some of our numbers in terms of working with women in prison coincide with the reports of DCS and JICS, but there are other things that are quite critical in terms of criminogenic environments and criminal career passing. 75% of women who are in prison have children. Most of them don't have contact with those children. Those children are sitting in foster care with extended families. The social and economic impact of putting women in prison is phenomenal on family members, on grandmothers, on grandparents. The corollary impact is incredibly significant. Most of these women had children for the first time when they were 16, 18, 19 years old. And unlike men, most that we interviewed, this was their first time in prison ever. Most of them were incarcerated after the age of 30, so all of the demographic indicators around women are very different to that of men. Men tend to be incarcerated much earlier and for a different range of reasons. And one-third of these women have been imprisoned for more than 10 years. I just want to show you something that we also picked up that we should be looking at when we're doing either DCS or JICS reporting, is that of getting a sense of prisoners' demographic information. For instance, we learned that 40% of the women that we interviewed had a family who has been or is in prison. That's quite significant. That's a really important criminogenic factor and criminality within family context. 64% of these were immediate family members, such as fathers and brothers. 25% were brothers, and 11% were extended family members. We found very high levels of abuse in our initial survey across the prisons. Women reported domestic violence or rape sometime during their lifetime, which is over double the rate of abuse reported in the general population. But when we had the in-depth interviews, the stories of violence started coming out, and there were multiple stories. Women talked about being sexually assaulted for the first time when they were 4, and then again at 11, and then again at 19, and then, the sort of criminal activities often had a lot to do with those experiences, drug taking, involvement in the wrong crowds, that sort of thing. So these types of numbers tell us a lot about violence and crime prevention and where we need to be focusing our attention. So 74% discussed some type of serious abuse during the interviews. The people who committed these acts against them is staggering. 62% of women said that the person who violated me the most in my life was a father figure or a male caregiver, okay, or other male relative or a neighbor and friend. Very few were unknowns. So women's life experiences are marred with deep violations within intimate spaces. And of those who had committed the top three serious crimes, murder, theft, robbery, fraud, and drug-related offenses, 56% of women who had committed murder had experienced child sexual abuse during the course of their lifetime. These are interesting things to know about who we're engaging with within the prison population. Why is this important, and what does this have to do with the annual reports? I'm going to try to answer that now. We first and foremostly lack knowledge about women in prison. There's a total lack of gender disaggregated data within both the DCS annual reports as well as in the JICS reports. What we do have is data on remand and sentenced prisoners, how many were female, the gender of the ICCVs, the gender of persons who died from unnatural deaths in custody, and then there's other indiscriminate human resources data, which is critical, but not in terms of what I'm arguing here. It really makes need-based interventions difficult to assess. It limits our ability to engage with DCS about research and interventions and what we should be doing with and alongside DCS and JICs around women who are imprisoned, and that includes support and rehabilitation services, understanding their role in crime, and of course reintegration. Like I said previously, one of the biggest fears that women have being incarcerated is how to reintegrate into a criminogenic society, high levels of violence, going back into social spaces where there's high levels of alcohol and drug abuse, and trying to engage with those figures. I'm a little bit surprised at the lack of reporting, because as far as I'm aware, the demographic admissions data is quite detailed when you enter a prison on biographical and health data. And in some instances, although a lot of women we spoke to said this didn't happen, there should be a needs assessment, which is meant to identify what their emotional vulnerabilities might be, such as depression or suicidal behavior. So here's an instrument that should be helping us prevent suicides in custody for all people in prison, security risks that the offender may pose, and apparently this is supposed to be done within 21 days. If we do have these offender profiles, we can better analyze what our risk situations are in terms of mental health and health issues as well as security and risk issues. Unfortunately, we, although it's collected, it doesn't seem to be collated and analyzed. We're not asking DCS and JICs for private information about people's personal mental health history, but a general sense of who's vulnerable to mental health concerns, serious health, chronic concerns, in order for us to manage that prison population a bit better. I'll be 2 minutes. In terms of the desegregation of data, we do have male prisoner data in both of the annual reports on things like skills development programs, education programs, literacy training, workshops. We have none of this data on women. We have no idea who's participating in recreational programs, who's getting mental health care services, how many were assaulted or experienced violence during incarceration. This data is all available for male prisoners, and we have an obligation, actually, to desegregate in terms of gender. This helps in terms of things like understanding offending. We found in our work that women do not engage in acts of primary offending like men do, but tend to be co-offenders. They tend to be subordinate offenders. They get involved in their husband's or partner's fraud activities. And they benefit from offending. So there's a whole different modeling that takes place in terms of women's criminal activity. And if we had this sort of data, we'd be able to do better work around prevention and rehabilitation. Not to mention their international and national obligations. The Correctional Services Act, of course, has created a gender-sensitive environment. Gender-sensitive isn't defined in the Act, but unfortunately how it's manifesting is showing, flower-arranging, very sort of gender-appropriate or inappropriate activities, whereas the women that we're talking to, their fears are about being able to open up a bank account, having basic business skills, understanding how to write a letter, you know, to engage in programs that are less about keeping the idle hands busy and giving them more technical skills. And then there's the United Nations Rules for the Treatment of Women Prisoners. These are called the Bangkok Rules. And they're non-binding, but they're incredibly helpful. They're being applied all over the Middle East and in some parts of East Africa. And the Bangkok Rules would help JICs, for instance, help review things like admission procedures, family contact, legal advice, caretaking, health, personal health, prison regimes. They're very simple guidelines as to what we should be looking at when we're overseeing the prison context, and they're incredibly helpful. And if we've signed up to the Tokyo Rules, these are sort of an addendum to the Tokyo Rules, and they're incredibly effective. So at minimum, my recommendation is the promotion of a more systematic collation and analysis of data. Those are three different things. We need to collect, We need to collate, we need to analyze, and then we have to publish. And a lot of the criticisms against both DCS and JICS is about data collection. It's not that the data is not being collected. It's just not being articulated in a format that's particularly helpful for the work that we need to be doing. Obviously, all data that's reporting on male prisoners, we should be able to report on female prisoners. It's a general principle that should apply across the board, and other vulnerable groups if relevant. And then the other thing that I think is important, which we haven't been discussing sort of as a broader criminal justice data reform process, is that we actually have no police data on how many women are actually arrested. So we look at our prison figures and we go, why should we worry? Only 2-3% of women are in prison. We do not know how many women have been arrested. We do not know how many women have been brought to trial, how many have been convicted, how many have been diverted out of the system, and how many have ended up with us. So I think it's an important interdepartmental discussion about how we collect data. And this should also apply to children as well. What we do have from SAPS is disaggregated data in terms of women and children as victims of crime, if we don't have them as offenders. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very helpful. Profile. Because then it actually manages to inform the process. A little bit of light. Can we have comments and questions from the members? Honorable Shabalala.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much. I'm not so sure if it's a comment that anybody should answer to. I guess it's just internal on our part as a committee. I think from what NICO presented to what UCT has presented, it is very clear that we, as society now, we can't solve this problem at that level of prison. It is clearly something that lies in the behavior of society, and this issue of her stating she gave the statistics in a graph, which was good, how many of these women in fact have fallen victim to sexual abuse who end up like this. I'm not sure if Nico has done that study, but I work a lot with young people, and it is the same scenario even with young people. So maybe in this fixed parliament at a certain stage, Chair, we need to be able to take some of these recommendations over to Minister Batabile's department. I'm not so sure what their programs are sitting here, but maybe they need to migrate more from, you know, the grant giving to more the psychosocial support. I don't think in South Africa we take that very seriously, because even in public hospitals, it is intensely difficult to refer people for psychosocial support, because when we deal with the cases at this level as a committee, we're already dealing with a problem. I think that could have been presented in some of these instances. That would be my comment there.
And just to say that what I appreciate also is the focus that has been put on women, because, you know, we sometimes forget to disaggregate data when it's very important, especially when you look at the situation of women. It's always important, and it shouldn't actually be women only. You can look at the situation of children the same way, so that we actually understand what we're dealing with, because you can before you can always manage to know what you should actually do in a form of intervention, you have to understand first. So basically what I really found more interesting is even your recommendation that we need to much more coordinate collection, coordination, and the analysis of data. And it still goes back to the partnership. And then it actually then puts light on what we are doing, and we can be in the position to really manage to, Honorable Smith, push this thing forward, because his frustration is that he's been in this Committee of Correctional Services for so long that he's tired of hearing all of these complaints without really getting the answers. We need to actually help ourselves as South Africans from various establishments to move this thing forward. So that when, in a murder and mystery report, we can say, but you know, in this and that area, with our help, JICS has managed to do this, or this DCS has actually managed to do this and this and that. And whatever is a problem, then we can all look at it together. The information that has been presented is really much appreciated. Do you still have more comments, questions? And one more time.
Honorable members, let me follow you and my colleague Honorable Chabalala to commend the presenter for the presentation. And again, I think we'll expect the DCS and JICS later to unpack the, let's say, on the issue of program of care, especially in relation to women. Maybe to unpack all these other issues or comments made by UCT presenter. But all in all, the presentation, Chairperson, is an eye-opener. And with the Progressive Act that we have, Correctional Services Act, I hope that later the department will be able to respond to all these, some or all these issues which have been raised. And some of us are new in this committee, and we are aware that the likes of Honorable Smith and Honorable Self, and maybe you also, might be knowing all these things. These issues might have been arising some during the last term, but this presentation, for some of us who are new in this committee, will sort of enhance our knowledge in this regard. Thank you.
I think this then brings us to the end of this session. To once more thank all the stakeholders for having been here today. Even if we've been critical in some of the areas, it's not to dampen the spirit. We can actually only manage to do so much if we all work together. One thing that is always important is to understand that it's important to monitor, it's important to criticize, but it's also important to look at ways of supporting whatever efforts are actually being put together. Thank you very much once more. The next session will take place in Parliament at S12A, and it will start at 2 o'clock. And then lunch will be served here at the hotel. Sia will accompany members, guests, to the dining hall. Thank you very much.